From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Electronic games began as entertainment, but they're fast becoming much, much more. Already, we use games to teach kids and to train doctors, to meet friends and to wage war. Today, how games could transform the world. If you grew up playing video games, you probably remember this. That's the theme from the Super Mario Brothers game, one of the most recognizable pieces of game music in existence. Of course, in the hands of serious musicians, it can also sound like this. That's from the Swedish jazz quartet Neskvartetten. If you're surprised to hear serious musicians inspired by video game music, well, that's just the beginning. Jazz club not your thing? Maybe you'd prefer a concert hall setting. That's a string arrangement by a composer who goes by the online name of Schnabubala. He calls that piece Mario Likes Thorazine. There's a growing online community of musicians and composers who believe video game music deserves serious artistic attention. We'll be playing more of their music this hour. But first, video games have grown up. Celebrities act in them. Famous directors like Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson design them. But electronic gaming isn't just about entertainment. British writer and game theorist Tom Chatfield believes games also have the potential to revolutionize a field that could use a dose of fun, education.
I'm really interested in games that don't label themselves as educational, but that offer intense and amazing learning experiences. I mean, one classic example is the game Civilization, that series of games where you are learning about the history of the world and great discoveries and inventions through a management game where you're managing a civilization. It's incredibly fun. And I also think that games are fantastic at teaching working with other people and at systems thinking, whether this is the body or the climate or a city or politics. And a good game is very, very much like a good learning experience.
You know, it's not unique to video games at all, is it? You can never get people to accept information just because you layer it on top of them. You have to find ways to let them discover it.
Exactly right, yeah. There are people who argue that, in fact, the best way to understand any video game is as a learning experience. It's trying to teach you to do something. If you think about sports, you are getting better and better and better at a set of activities. And a really good sport is one in which there are immense possibilities of sort of skill and mastery, but it's still fun to start out. And a good learning experience should often look like that. It should encourage people. It should inspire an appetite for excellence, but also interest while you're doing it. There's some very complicated stuff going on in all this. Sad to say, commercial games really show up the limitations of mainstream teaching.
Well, I'm curious about that, because the comparison between video games and sports is obvious enough. What about classroom? Are there any games that do teach you things that you really need to know?
Well, I talk in the book about some fantastic work going on in Scotland, where they've started using games, Guitar Hero in particular. Students make up a band, they send it on tour, they then book hotels, they work in different languages, they do conversions, they release their band's album, they market it, they go to other schools and have playoffs and battles. And the act of play unlocks lots of incredible learning.
Is it true that the US Army is using video games to train soldiers now? That seems like anathema, one to the other.
Well, it's interesting you say it seems like anathema, because if you look at the history of games, games and warfare are intimately linked throughout their history. And in fact, if you want to practice warfare, if you're an ancient Greek or a Bronze Age warrior, warfare cannot really be practiced except by playing games, because if you're not playing a game, people die. And yes, the US military is spending more than $6 billion annually on games and game-like simulations. And in fact, you're beginning to see, I think, a very disturbing collision between virtual and real environments, where unpiloted drones and robots and that kind of technology are being controlled through video game interfaces, through virtual three-dimensional worlds, that pretty much, at the flick of a switch, you can go from being in control of a virtual object in a virtual world to controlling a real drone or real robot in the real world. They are incredibly good at doing this, perhaps worryingly good.
What about other areas of our lives? Could video games be used for political ends, for social ends? Could we develop political or social awareness with video games?
Well, I think this is already happening, really. Some of the most impressive electoral achievements of the last few years have taken place in games. A game called EVE Online organised an election involving people in more than 50 countries to elect people on its stellar council in there. And then there are also lessons we can take away from, if you like, looking at how people behave in game environments, to do with economics, to do with politics, to do with cooperation.
You recently did a TED Talk, and one of the things that was fascinating is an experience at Indiana University. They've done away with grades in one classroom experience, and in some senses almost taken the student out of the classroom and allowed the student to put an avatar in its place?
That's right, yeah. It's the idea of using an experience system rather than grading. And instead of whether you've got, you know, an A or a B or a C for a particular test, you're accumulating points on one large scale over time. And this has a number of advantages. People invest in this much more clearly on an emotional level. They own this steady incremental progress of their little kind of character, their little miniature self. But also, they can see very clearly where they're going, where they've come from, where they lie in relation to everywhere else. And this is very inspiring. It's one of the great things about a game is you walk in, you've never played before, and you see around you people who are powerful and expert and amazing, but you also exist on exactly the same sort of scale as them, and you can see your little experience points ticking over. If you work hard enough, you will get there, your experience will reach that level. And in a school, you know, you see usually no connection at all between the test you're doing and what someone who has a doctorate in physics or is a professor is doing. They're different worlds. It doesn't make sense. And the idea of this continual progress and the excitement it generates and the fact that it replaces this idea of sort of failure and punishment with continual, incremental, personal progress. This is all very powerful stuff.
So what do you think about the future of the games? Where do you see video gaming going?
The interesting thing for me is that a few years ago, people saw the future in terms of immersive virtual realities, which sort of vanish into virtual worlds. And in fact, the future's looking less and less like that. The future's looking more and more like a world in which people are casually playful, where people have a powerful mobile device in their bag and in their pocket, and they like logging in to play casual fun games and to do things asynchronously with each other, which means I do a move now and then, you know, in a couple of hours' time you can make your move or you can update your farm or harvest your crops. And this barrier between sort of work and play, I think, is breaking down a bit.
Several times in our conversation you've pointed out the similarities between sport and games. Sport, of course, involves, in many cases, thousands of people watching as a game is played. And that, at least as far as I know, doesn't really happen in the world of video games. Do you think it might be added?
I've got to contradict you there and say it does happen. It's already starting to happen. If you were to go to South Korea and you were to ask what the two most viewed sports were, soccer would be number one. But video gaming would be number two. It's the second most televised sport. You can get crowds of over 100,000 people turning up in a stadium to watch a live match between two StarCraft gaming champions. And what I think we're going to see is people being more and more interested in watching expert gamers, in watching kind of gaming heroes playing games in YouTube and also at live events. So I think in that sense, it's almost inevitable.
Tom Chatfield is the author of Fun, Inc., Why Gaming Will Dominate the 21st Century. Imagine you're sitting on the bus. on your way home from work. To pass the time, you take out your smartphone or computer notebook. You play a game. But instead of shooting angry birds or harvesting crops in Farmville, you choose a game that lets you blast imaginary cancer cells. Except they're not imaginary. They're from a real cancer patient, and the game you play may help save a life. That's The Future, an interdisciplinary team of biologists, education researchers, and game designers is working on at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Strange Champs visited the Educational Game Lab at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery and got Professors Susan Millar, Kurt Squire, and one of their students to show her a game.
So Oncology is this is a game prototype that's designed to give you, the player, the experience of being a doctor. So we'll pick a patient here. We'll pick Mr. Badger. And this is a patient who you start reading about their history and you realize that they're here because of carcinoma in their tongue. And the first thing that you do is you talk to the patient, get a little sense of their life history. In this case, we find out that he's smoked for 30 years and is tempting to quit, and that's probably going to be a part of what's happening.
I see. He says grumble.
Yes, he says grumble. Yeah, he's not happy about having to quit smoking. And here, what you're seeing is actual, authentic. This is an actual patient's CT scan that you're looking at here. This is a real thing that doctors would look at. We have some kind of hints and guides to help the new player who may never have looked at these before. When a physician looks at this, and they can kind of jump right in and start to know where the cancer is.
This is level one amateur.
Yeah. And what you do is, as you go down, you pick the different slices, and then you target where you think it would be. And then when you're done, you hit submit, and you get feedback. So you can see your accuracy. Actually, I had 0% accuracy, and I wasn't getting any healthy tissue. So I have to go back and try it again. Once it's kind of close enough, we let the person go into the next phase, which is where they set up the beams, and they actually treat the player.
And then once you've treated the player, does it say success, you've eradicated the tumor?
It's more complicated than that. It's like, how much of the healthy tissue did you harm that you shouldn't have? How much of the cancerous tissue did you actually get?
It can have a really strong emotional impact on the player, particularly if they've really trying to kind of save this player. And then sometimes they realize no matter what they do, there's nothing they can do to save them. And we've had people worry, as they start kind of tearing up a bit, is this going to be too emotional? And we think that's a good thing. We think having people emotionally invested in their learning and really caring, because it really makes a difference in the world, we think that's really a good thing.
So unlike having your 15-year-old kid play hours of Call of Duty and become extremely good at killing people, in this case, your 15-year-old could play Oncology and become incredibly good at targeting tumors.
Right, and in an ideal world, if they were participating in helping to identify a cancerous tumor for a real patient, and if we would get the medical people to provide information about the outcomes for those patients, that could be really powerful.
So explain this. You might actually, at some level, these wouldn't just be fictional patients. These,
right.
There might be real patients.
They would be anonymized. The players would never know who the actual individuals were, but they would be able to know that there were successful treatments. Or, as Kurt was saying, maybe they wouldn't be so successful, in which case it is a little scary.
One of the issues is that there's actually a lot of variance right now in how different doctors read these images and then how they treat them. There's enough that it's a little scary, and I suggest anyone out there get a second and third and fourth opinion. But there's research findings based on this. Like, literally, well, they'll take five doctors, line them up, look at the same image, and they will treat it in five wildly different ways.
So explain again how this would work. How do you get the mythical 13-year-old kid who's playing this? At what point does that kid go from playing a fictional game to actually being able to treat real or help treat real patients?
So imagine they encounter this game first as a part of a health class where they're learning probably a couple things. One, some basic anatomy. So they're having to contour the parts of the body, and they learn both the names of the systems and then what they actually do. And then two, they could be learning about future careers in science. So many people may not know that there are huge career opportunities for technicians and so on, radiologists. And then third, they might say, if you're playing this and you play some at home and you get really good at it, there actually is an opportunity to work with real patients. And at that point, they would be playing the game, but there would also be an online community of different players, some of whom are medical professionals. And then at that point, it would largely probably be outside of class, although it's entirely possible a teacher could say, one way to get an A in this course is to actually get to become that level of,
So it's performance-based, definitely performance-based. You'd have to be able to perform largely at the level of the expert radiologists.
Can you imagine a day when a doctor who's treating a patient for cancer might get a scan and say, you know what, I'm not really sure of my reading on this. Let me see what the eighth grade class down the street thinks about this.
Yeah, we talk about getting a second opinion, a third opinion, a 2 millionth of opinion. So you could imagine them seeing, you know, here's someone who's rated maybe 500 images and has been rated to be a real expert, and they could go look at that person's experience. And we could even combine the experts' kind of second opinions of millions of people and then create an aggregate optimized sort of solution that is based on pulling all those different opinions together.
Is this eventually leading to crowdsourcing cancer treatment?
That's our dream. We believe that there's a lot of energy out in the public not being effectively used. Clay Shirky is calling it a cognitive surplus. But we believe that we can take that creative energy and harness it for all kinds of positive outcomes such as this one.
So now the other game we were going to look at is Virulent. What are we looking at here?
So this game gives a player a deep understanding of just kind of the way a virus infects a cell, the steps that it has to go through to reproduce itself, and kind of what it does while it's in the cell, and what actually constitutes an infection.
I think it's deeply engaging. I've watched a number of young people play it, and they actually get really identified with being a virus and get upset when they fail to infect the cell and to replicate themselves. And I particularly failed when I played it, because I couldn't even get into the cell at first. And then when I got into the cell, I got zapped by, what were those things called? The little
slicers.
The slicers. They beat me. They sliced me.
You know, one thing, if you've ever tried to learn this in school, one of the real challenges is that you'll read a textbook definition, which you actually have here on the screen. You know, RNA genomes also need energy to make mRNA. And you read that, and these are all complicated words, like nouns you don't know, describing these verbs you don't know. And you might get a picture, whereas in this case, you actually get to do it. So you're getting language connected to what you're actually doing, which is the best way to learn. It's meaningful. It's in context. It relates to what they're trying to do.
Well, and I can see just from looking at this, you know, it's like some cool kind of space-based game. It sort of looks vaguely like we're in outer space and there are stars scattered
it's
around.
Inner space.
Yes, inner space. And this thing that the mitochondria looks like some weird yellow docking station, and there's something else that looks like a purple asteroid. And so I can see suddenly I would have no trouble at all remembering what a mitochondria is.
Yeah. You know, the big old yellow thing that I, yeah.
So what do the virologists think of this game?
Oh, the virologists love it. For them, part of there's a real joy in seeing the work that they do every day turned into a video game and put on screen. But then secondarily, they start to think about their own models that they have. And, you know, as they see it represented, they say, is that really how it happens? So you might have an immunologist and a virologist playing together and then having a discussion about what each one thinks happens. So if we can build something for them to have a conversation to move forward, then we know that we're doing a good job because we're pushing the boundaries of our understandings of these systems.
So you've got a game here that virologists and immunologists can sit around and argue about and say, no, that's not how it works. I think that, you know, RNA replicates this way. And at the same time, a 15-year-old kid might just think this is fun to play.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
That's what we mean by authentic learning. If it's fun for the scientists, it should also be fun for other people. And because the way these games are leveled, the first time a player goes in as an amateur, they're going to see entirely different things and have entirely different challenges than the virologists who are going to see things in a completely different way.
One of my colleagues, Julian DeBell, says that, you know, mouse clicks are kind of the 21st century steam engine, right? So there are all these people who are playing games and identifying patterns, and it's kind of all going up into the ether. And if we could design games where people are we're using those mouse clicks as ways to help use people's natural pattern recognizing ability or problem solving ability, and then use them as a way to further social good, we have a real opportunity for something transformative.
Susan Millar and Kurt Squires are education researchers and experts on game-based learning at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. If you want to see their games or find out how to play them yourself, check our website for links. It's ttbook.org. Coming up, a young adult novel introduces teens to the global politics of video games. And remember the good old days when playing a fantasy game meant running around the woods with a homemade sword? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
If you've ever played one of the big online multiplayer fantasy games like World of Warcraft, you know that in the beginning there's a certain amount of drudge work. Your character has to shear a bunch of sheep to make shirts, or dig a lot of ore, or kill monsters in order to acquire the good stuff. Swords, gold, spaceships, laser guns. And that takes time. There is an alternative. You can pay someone else to do it for you. The practice is called gold farming, and it's the subject of a new young adult novel by Cory Doctorow called For the Win. And Strange Champs asked, what kind of gamer would hire someone else to do their playing?
Well, there's lots of different cases for it. Say your partner has been playing Warcraft for a year and she's gotten up to some unimaginable height through hundreds of hours of play, and you've decided that it's time that you and your partner will play together. The problem is that for you to get to a level where you can play alongside her best character, you're going to have to play for hundreds and hundreds of hours on your own, or with other players who are kind of at the same level as you, or she's going to have to tag along in a bunch of really boring quests with you. So you might pay someone to level your character up. Gold farmers do this. They do these repetitive tasks, and then they find a way to sell those items to other players for real money. There are about 400,000 people who do this for a living. Most of the farmers are in poor countries, and most of the customers for their gold are in rich countries.
Do they make much money doing this?
Probably not. You know, it's hard to say because this is a gray market, so it's very hard to tell exactly how much money anyone's making doing it. One of the most interesting things I heard about gold farming when I was interviewing experts about it is that there's a kind of pervasive get-rich-quick story in the outer provinces of China where there's been a very aggressive effort to add high-speed networks to a lot of very economically depressed regions in the hopes that that will spur local business. And the idea is that if you could get, say, 10 boys who are out of work to come and sit in a room full of computers and play video games all day, that you can get rich off their play. The socialist in me wants to call this alienating them from the product of their leisure. It's probably not the case that any of those people who start those businesses get rich, or most of them probably don't, because that's in the nature of get-rich schemes. But that doesn't mean that someone isn't making money somewhere.
So we're talking about an entire network of electronic sweatshops.
Yeah, some of them are really sweatshops. You know, I talked to farmers and people who ran farms and experts who described things that we would characterize as being normal for sweatshops, like places where you're locked in, where you sleep in a dormitory that's attached to your place of work, where your salary is docked if you do kind of things that we would consider normal, like slowing down a little while or going to the bathroom too often. And some of them, I think, are just a couple of guys, usually guys, who figured out that they can make money doing it as independents or semi-independents.
Well, so far, this seems like a great subject for an investigative piece, you know, a newspaper, a magazine story. What made you want to turn it into a young adult novel?
You know, the business of gold farming, it's got a lot of parallels and resonances with some of the big fights that we're having right now. So in virtual worlds, in games, people who are, quote, real players from the rich world look down on gold farmers and think of them as cheaters. Although, of course, as you pointed out, they're also their customers. And it's the source of a lot of racism and really ugly stuff that people who walk around in video games who have Chinese names and talk in Chinese to each other often find themselves being harassed by players from the developed world saying, you know, you're a dirty gold farmer, you've come here, you're unwelcome, go home, you're a cheater, you enable people to cheat, get lost, with, you know, a lot of racial epithets thrown in for good measure. And so that's pretty, you know, distressing. But what's interesting is that the claim of legitimacy that the, quote, real players have is no less tenuous than the claim of legitimacy that the gold farmers have. So first of all, the gold farmers, some of them anyways, will tell you, well, I have a claim to legitimacy on two grounds. The first is that I play this game for 12 to 18 hours a day, and I'm better at it than you are. And the second one is that because this game is not only the thing that I do for leisure, but also the thing that I do for my bread, this game matters to me more than it does to you. I'm actually more of a legitimate player than you are. You're you know, just a punter. I spend my life here. Now, at the same time, the people who run the games will tell both of those groups of players, actually, none of you have any stake or legitimacy here. You are here at our sufferance. Every time you log in, you have to click on a multi-thousand-word license agreement that spells out in agonizing detail just how few rights and how little legitimacy any of your claims to being the true residents of this world are. And moreover, you know, if you play a game like World of Warcraft from Blizzard, they mandatorily install spyware on your computer to make sure that you're not doing anything while you're playing the game that they would disapprove of, like running something that would automate game processes. So this program, which is unashamedly called Warden, actually can look at every file on your hard drive and report on its contents to, you know, Universal, who own Blizzard.
Well, you can see that the stage is set for some kind of massive democratic labor organization or movement, which is exactly what you created in your novel.
That's right. So, you know, For the Win, it's a book not just about gold farming, but it's a book about using gold farms or using virtual worlds to form trade unions that are independent in places where trade unionism is presently illegal, or at least independent trade unionism is illegal, whether that's free trade zones in India or China or Vietnam or Cambodia or other countries as well. And kids are able to do this for two reasons. The first is that they're doing so in a virtual world, and that virtual world is a place that's hard for their bosses to surveil, because they are better at using the virtual worlds than their bosses are. And the other reason is that all the workers are in the same place. So though it's easy to take a video game sweatshop and go, well, if you guys want to unionize, we'll move to the next village down, or we'll move the gold farm to Eastern Europe, or we'll move the gold farm to Singapore, that the union organizers can go to the same place that you've gone to and start sidling up alongside of the orcs who work for you making virtual gold and say, hey, comrade, have you ever thought that we have common cause even though we come from different countries?
So let's talk a little bit about the story you created and what happens in it. The book begins with a number of different characters. There are gold farming kids in you've got characters in Mumbai, in Singapore, in China. One by one, all these people wind up meeting a mysterious game player who calls herself Big Sister Noor. Who is she?
Noor's an Indonesian labor activist who was a gamer who happened to work in a textile mill and who found herself unemployed when her employers shut down the mill and moved to a free trade zone, but discovered in the virtual worlds that she liked to play in the seeds of a better union movement, one in which you could follow capital to any place that it would go to, and who decided to found something that she calls the Industrial Workers of the World Wide Web, or the Weblies. And she's holed up. Thank you. Yeah, I like that too. So Big Sister Noor is holed up in Singapore in the red light district, the Geylang, hidden away in an internet cafe, commanding this global army of trade unionists, along with two of her trusted lieutenants, a woman from Malaysia and a young man from China.
Are any of the events that take place in your book based on things that are really actually happening? I mean, are there instances of collective action taking place in online games?
No, not to my knowledge, although there have been, you know, some instances in which there were popular revolts in games. One of my favorite examples of this was several years ago in a game called EVE Online. It's nominally a game about space pirates and space merchants, but they call it Spreadsheets in Space because the way that you play the game is by forming corporations and then managing your supply chain and your human resources. It's essentially, they've kind of gamified middle management. It's very weird, but a lot of people really enjoy playing it, and you know, you either become a merchant or you become a pirate. And the people who ran the game decided that being a pirate wasn't fun enough. So they gave the pirates a better ship. And the merchants started to lose a lot of ground to the pirate. It became a lot less fun to be a merchant. And the merchants were very upset about this. And a couple of prominent merchants decided that they were going to have a little revenge. So they formed a syndicate, and they asked all the biggest corporations in the game to come into their syndicate and solicited from them their liquid capital in order to raise the money to buy a set of plans to build a ship that would outmaneuver the pirates and rebalance the game. Except there was no set of plans. There was no ship. It was a Ponzi scheme.
Their objective was to suck up as much of the liquid capital as they could from the game and then resign their accounts, at which point all that money would just disappear. And when that happened, the game went through a deflationary whipsaw, and it completely knocked the game's economy off kilter. So this is pretty amazing, right? This is a pretty amazing example of collective action in a game. And actually, you know, today EVE Online is distinctive in that it has an in-house economist and it has a democratically elected player guild or player council who have a say in the management of the game, which is pretty interesting.
So would you like to see young players, young gamers, thinking about taking on more forms of democratic collective action inside the games they play?
Not just games, right? So this is the thing, is the game is just a symbol for an overall fight about legitimacy and claims to legitimacy in networks and in cultural realms and in physical places. The physical wire in the ground. We have cable companies and phone operators who have been given government largesse in the form of a right of way. You know, imagine if you were Ma Bell and you said, okay, I'm going to start a new company and I'm going to buy the right to run wire under every street and to every basement in America at the clearing price of those rights of way. You know, $1 trillion later, you still wouldn't have wired half the country, but they get to do it for free. And yet they get to say, that's our wire, not your wire. When the FCC tells them that they have to run that network in a neutral fashion that allows everyone to connect to it, they say, you have no legitimate claim to our free enterprise network. You know, I want to say, you know, it's our dirt, it's our rules. If you put your wires in our dirt, you got to play by the rules. If you don't like the rules, you know, we'll give you 60 days. Get your wires out of our dirt. Otherwise, we'll pay you the scrappage cost of them and find someone who will operate the network we want. So this fight keeps going on all over the place. You know, when a kid takes a character in a book that they love and writes some fan fiction and puts it online or in a movie that they love or what have you, and a corporate publisher or corporate film studio writes to them and says, you've got to take that offline because that's not your character. It doesn't belong to you. And the kid says, well, wait a second. You conjured up a character that you deliberately stuck in my head. That character went on to do things in my head. Who are you to say I'm not allowed to write them down, right? These claims of legitimacy kind of echo up and down the whole of 21st century society. That's always being negotiated, and that's what this is really a book about.
Cory Doctorow talking with Anne Strainchamps about his new young adult novel, For the Win. He's a former director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a co-editor of Boing Boing, and author of the award-winning young adult novel, Little Brother. And now, remember when playing fantasy games with your friends meant doing something real? Like making a suit of armor or running around the woods with a sword? Aubrey Ralph does.
About 15 years ago, my friend Mike took me to a park near my home in Florida and brought me into a group that I would never forget, the SCA, Society for Creative Anachronism. If you've not heard of them, they're a worldwide group dedicated to recreating the arts and sciences of the Middle Ages. You could almost think of them as experimental archaeologists, with members studying everything from medieval recipes and songs to art and chemistry. But what they're really known for is the fighting, heavy armored combat. Well, it's a Wednesday night in Madison, half a lifetime later, and I'm walking up to a fighter practice. I know I'm in the right place because there are armored soldiers milling around outside. The fighters in the SCA are broken up into a few different groups. Armored combat, rapier, which is like fencing, and archery. I got to fight as a Roman legionary. Armored infantry. I do mean armored, too. This is no costume stuff. All the weapons are made from inch-thick rattan, and that can pack a serious punch. Your armor has to be able to stand up to it. This is an area where the diversity and time span of the SCA really shines through.
It's 600 to 1600, so if you want to do Dark Ages Frank from right after the fall of Rome, you can do that. If you want to do a 16th century Knight of Queen Elizabeth, you can do that too.
Most people make the bulk of their armor themselves, one piece at a time. You go to an armorer's house, and they show you how to pattern and cut the metal, and then hammer it to shape and fit and form. When it's finished, your efforts are put to the test, not only at the biweekly fighter practices, but also at huge gatherings called wars, held several times a year around the country. Imagine a medieval tent city and bazaar adjoining a battlefield. There's music and games and things to buy and eat and drink, and of course the war itself. At the big fights, there can be hundreds of soldiers on each side. Units are lined up, and then the call is given. Huge formations march towards each other, slowly at first, and then nearly running. Your breath is hot and loud in your helmet. Shield up and sword at the ready. All your muscles are tensed for the crash, and then it begins.
It's a pretty intense experience. There's a lot of stuff coming at you really fast. If you don't react properly, you get hit sometimes. And that's not always fun.
Fighting is hard, and you might be killed, but just for a little while. After it's over, you get back in line and do it all over again. So if your real-world life is lacking in community and thrill, and virtual worlds aren't for you either, the SCA just might be. With time and patience and hard work, you can advance through the ranks, perhaps even to royalty. A former baroness I spoke with told me the reason she first joined.
They were going to let me wear pretty dresses. That was it?
Me too. That was pretty much it.
They were going to let me wear pretty dresses whenever I wanted, and fantastic.
I think we can all raise a glass of mead to that.
Aubrey Ralph is an independent producer in Madison, Wisconsin. Writer Ethan Gilsdorf also recently undertook a nostalgic trip back in time to his geeky teenage past. A 40-something former Dungeons & Dragons addict, Gilsdorf is the author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks, a combination memoir and travelogue. It's a story about role players, online gamers, and other citizens of imaginary realms. Gilsdorf told Steve Paulson that for him, it all began the summer he was 12.
Well, at the time, I was dealing with some very difficult things at home. My mother had recently suffered a major brain aneurysm. She survived it, but she came home from the hospital a greatly changed woman. And as a kid, as a 12-year-old kid, myself and my sister and brother and I were really quite scared and a little intimidated and just honestly a little bit freaked out about what this was going to be like. So lo and behold, there was a kid across the street from my small town in New Hampshire who showed up one day and said, "Have you ever heard of this game, Dungeons & Dragons?" And he went ahead and explained to me this wonderful game where you get to play a character and go off on adventures and kill monsters and feel heroic and do things that you can't do in real life. And it really created for me a sense of empowerment and a sense of being able to do something when in my own world, you know, things were really kind of careening off the rails in many ways.
So did this become kind of an alternative reality for you?
It definitely did. I mean, you know, I played every Friday night from 5 o'clock till 11 o'clock from about 8th grade to my senior year in high school. And this was a regular group of kids, boys mostly, who played every week. It was also a world that I think is, you know, linked kind of in spirit with, you know, a book like Lord of the Rings, anything that's fantasy or science fiction. That kind of world that has a way of occupying one's mind, allowing you to really just disconnect from reality.
Well, it sounds like this occupied your whole high school experience. And of course, there are stereotypes about the kids who play Dungeons & Dragons. They're the geeks, the outsiders, some would say the losers in the jock culture of high school. Do those stereotypes have some truth?
Well, at the time, back in the 70s and 80s, they absolutely did have truth. And I was a kid who was pretty shy and pretty introverted. And I didn't have a lot of self-confidence, and I didn't really have the kind of courage to sort of think to my mind, you know, I'm going to do what I want, and I don't care what everybody else thinks. The irony, of course, is that now, you know, 25 years later, everyone is playing games like this. So the stigma has lessened in many ways, although I would say there are people who are happy to play, let's say, Farmville or Mafia Wars on Facebook, but they would never, you know, be caught dead playing Dungeons & Dragons, let alone dress up in a costume and run around in the woods. It's just
which you have done, I might add.
I did do in the course of writing this book and researching the book.
You obviously have kept your foot in the role-playing fantasy world really for your whole life, and you say that this has been an issue over the years with various girlfriends you've had, and there's often a moment of truth when you have to decide how much of your obsession with fantasy culture you should tell them.
Absolutely. To a certain extent, it had attached a lot of shame to these activities because they were really a kind of admission of defeat in some way.
So give me an example of that. I mean, when when you finally revealed some of your dirty secrets to a girlfriend, what might happen?
Well, I had at one point rediscovered all of my old Dungeons & Dragons stuff. It was in a box in my parents' basement, and this happened around the time that I turned 40. And the girlfriend that I had at the time, I think, was sort of amused by it, but I think she wasn't sure what to make of me now that I had embarked on this kind of resaturation or re-geeking of myself, you know, back into this world. And it really raised a lot of questions for her about, could you be an adult and be responsible and get a real job and kind of go along the standard path in life and yet still be interested in these quote-unquote childish things?
Well, and you write that your first adult geek moment was putting on chainmail.
Right.
Things got a little more serious at that point.
Yeah, in the course of writing the book, of course, the intent was to really participate in some fandom activities, like some of the more rabid ways to express your interest or fealty to, for example, Lord of the Rings. You know, when the Lord of the Rings movies came out in 2001, 2002, and 2003, that was another kind of warning sign to me, because I thought, wow, I really am getting into these movies in kind of a scary way.
One thing that's so striking about the Lord of the Rings and much of today's fantasy culture, including online games like World of Warcraft, is that it's an imagined medieval world with swords and horses and dragons and elves. Why is this medieval fantasy so appealing?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Traditionally, there's been a bit of a divide between, let's say, people who are into science fiction and people who are into fantasy. And generally speaking, science fiction books and science fiction movies are fairly pessimistic. You know, they're set in the future, usually after everything's gone to hell in a handbasket and, you know, global Armageddon has happened and it's people riding around, you know, it's Mel Gibson riding around in these, you know, souped up vehicles, you know, fighting each other for the last droplets of gasoline, or it's the robots have taken over. And oftentimes it's some struggle of, you know, man versus the machine, and ultimately the man will win, sort of like you see in Star Wars, for example. But it's a kind of pessimistic view that's very dystopian. Whereas in the medieval world, at least the way we would like to imagine it, you know, this is before global warming. This is before ATM machines and looking for parking and anything that had anything to do with technology. And when you're in that world, you get to reconnect with nature. You get to solve your problems in a very direct way, even though we can't really get away with solving our problems with duels and challenging people to fight with battle axes, you know, to figure out some kind of problem between you and your, you know, shift supervisor at Best Buy or something like that. We can't do that, of course, but there's something in our psyche, in our bodies that wants to take a sword and just run into the woods and save the day and defeat evil.
And there are people who quite literally take swords and run into the woods. And you visited some other fantasy subcultures as well. For instance, LARPs, live-action role-playing games. What happens in these?
Well, they're essentially like playing Dungeons & Dragons. And for many people who play D&D, imagining it wasn't quite enough. And they wanted to actually dress up like a wizard or dress up like a warrior and go on these adventures in real life. Now, they still don't really fight each other and draw blood and kill each other. They have combat systems that allow them to solve problems without actually inflicting bodily harm. Depending on which rule system you're working with, you know, some of them are very non-lethal. They use rock, paper, scissors to determine the outcomes of battles.
Now, I have to say, there is sometimes something a little weird about how far these obsessions can go. And I guess the question is whether it's unhealthy. What do you think?
Well, this is the big, you know, $60,000 question, and it's something that a lot of pop cultural phenomena over the years have had to, the hurdle they had to get over was new thing comes along, parents, teachers don't understand it, it gets vilified, and then gradually it becomes accepted, and then, you know, there's another thing that comes along, and you could use any number of examples. Beatles and Elvis Presley, comic books, horror movies, rap music, heavy metal music, they've all been vilified in their day and considered to be either dangerous or corrupting.
And then on the other side, what people often say about playing these fantasy games is that those worlds are more exciting than the real world of everyday life. I mean, that's why they're so attractive.
Exactly. And a lot of the games, of course, are designed to give you a kind of sense of instant achievement and instant feedback. Is it addictive? Maybe. Are addictive personalities attracted to some of these games? Certainly. But I would hope that as we become a more and more of a gaming society, and it's clearly heading in this direction, whether it's a really immersive game like World of Warcraft or something that you just do on the side, like playing Scrabble with people over Facebook, people do have the capability to still find pleasure and still find fulfillment in, quote unquote, the real world, whatever that means.
Ethan Gilsdorf is the author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. He spoke with Steve Paulson. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Media theorist Douglas Rushkoff says the writing's on the wall. In the future, you can either make the software or you can be the software. You may remember Doug Rushkoff. He's written a dozen best-selling books on media and society, including Siberia and Media Virus. He minted the concept of viral marketing and made the frontline documentaries Digital Nation and Merchants of Cool. Now he's back with a new book, Program or Be Programmed. It opens with a story he told Ann Strangchamps about a recent visit to an Air Force general.
Yeah, well, I went down to Shreveport, Louisiana, to meet with the general who was then in charge of the Air Force Cyber Command. And he said he was getting a ton of recruits joining the Air Force who are, you know, more than happy to fly drones and operate tanks from 6,000 miles away in a, you know, in a hangar in Arlington, Virginia, but finding very, very few, if any, kids enlisting who understood how to program any of these things. So he had plenty of operators, and they were all very experienced through their video games to, you know, to twitch and turn and fire. But he didn't have anyone who could go in and program how do the drones actually work. You know, and he's looking at other countries. He's looking at Iran and China and India and Pakistan and Korea and North Korea and seeing that these places have programmers coming out of their public schools. You know, it's part of their regular curriculum. He believes that within a generation, you know, we'll no longer have cyber superiority.
So the difference between, say, an American teenager and maybe a Chinese or an Indian or Iranian teenagers, they may all be playing Call of Duty or Halo, but the kids in the other countries are actually learning how to create their own games?
Right. In South Korea, they teach kids how to design characters for video games and computer games, how to program them, how to create a game engine, how to use ones that are there. You know, the basic building blocks of the communications languages of the 21st century.
I imagine that you are not suggesting that we all go out and become computer programmers or that we raise an entire generation of children who will be computer programmers. I think you were suggesting that learning to program is about learning how to think.
Right. I believe that the languages of a particular era really do define the way power is distributed, the way decisions are made. I think it's really important for people in the 21st century who are living on a digital operating system to have some facility with digital language. You know, just as early humans began to speak, I think those who knew how to speak, who could structure language, had a real advantage over those who didn't know what was going on. You know, with the invention of text, those who knew how to read and write had an advantage. Those were the people who built the systems of law that were used for the next 2,000 years. So now that we have this very new language, and now that that is the language that is, it's the medium through which everybody's interacting, having some knowledge of that medium, of the biases of that medium, of how it works, can make you a much more conscious actor in your own life, in the world that you're living.
Let's play this out in terms of games. People talk about us becoming a gaming society. Where does that take us, do you think?
Well, it's a different medium. So you have to start looking at how is the experience of narrativity and entertainment changing, you know, and then how does that change our society? If we move into a society where the dominant form of cultural expression is some sort of experiential gaming, it changes everything. And then it depends what kind of game is this? Is this a game where there's a whole bunch of us with avatars interacting together like World of Warcraft or Second Life? Or is this a solo game that I put on my Xbox and or my Wii and then navigate a path through this world while different things happen to me? Is it a game like a SimCity or a building game where I create a civilization, a sort of open-ended thing that happens over months as I create something? And how do each of these gaming archetypes, how do they structure my thinking? What will religion look like when it is transmitted to people through game? What will politics look like when it's transmitted to people through game?
Well, and you're throwing out all these fascinating questions. Can you answer any of them? I mean, what would religion look like, or what would politics look like in a gaming society?
It all depends whether or not the people playing the games know that they're games. Do people understand that the stock market is a game, that there's programmers right now creating algorithms to beat the algorithms of other programmers, that it's got nothing to do with whether these companies are making or losing money, and everything to do with whether my derivatives algorithm can beat your derivatives algorithm at predicting the next trade in an ultra-fast computing trading scenario? You know, do people know that or not? Some of the programmers do, and some of the people paying those programmers do, but the rest of us are kind of left thinking that this is real economics or that this is real business at play, and it's not.
So, Doug, you have kids, right?
I have a daughter, yeah.
I think she's still on the young side, at least. I think I heard you refer to playing Polly Pocket the other day.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do about when she's old enough to want to play electronic games, whatever form they come in when she's 10 years older? What are you going to want her to learn?
Well, I'm hoping that she approaches everything the same way. You know, if she's into Barbies, then it's like, well, who makes Barbies? What are the values in Barbies? What do Barbies think about? Do you like the way they think or not? This game, oh, cool. Who made this game? What is this game doing? What are the values implicit in this game? How does it work? Do we like everything about it? If there's something we don't like, how can we make it the way we want it to be? You're basically asking, how are you going to deal with the tooth fairy? You know, are you going to lie or are you going to tell her the truth?
Douglas Rushkoff talking with Anne Strainchamps about his most recent book called Program or Be Programmed. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Thanks for listening this hour. If you want to hear it again or recommend it to a friend, you can get the podcast from our website at ttbook.org. If you want a hard copy on CD, talk to the folks at the radio store. The number is 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Gaming Show, number 213A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by a bunch of people who consider radio to be the best game around. Special thanks this week to Leanne Ziegler. Kirill Owen makes it all sound good, and our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.